It's wonderful to be here at Brana this morning with all of you. It always mystifies me when I get chosen to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. Can you hear me? Is that why you're waving?
Yes.
Talk louder. How's that? Okay, well, it always mystifies me when I get chosen to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. Because anybody who knows me knows that, my favorite defect is to every now and then kick something and curse, you know, which isn't the defect that springs to mind for the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. I've gotten better about that, but it certainly isn't something that's gone completely away. But, you know, I will say that I guess what I do have in common with every speaker I've ever heard on Sunday morning is that I love Narcotics Anonymous. You know, Narcotics Anonymous has changed me since I got here. And it's changed me because I've been teachable and I've remained teachable. And because I've been willing to do the work, to work the steps in this program, and to learn from my mistakes, and to make different mistakes. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, when I got the call last night, I already had a commitment that I had made that I thought might conflict with being able to do this. And so I asked for some help. And that would have been such an unnatural act for me in my life. Before I got clean, I believed my job, before I ever started using, but particularly before I got clean, I thought my job was to try to figure out how to bend the world to my will all alone. You know, that I didn't ask anybody for anything, because I didn't want to ever take the chance of owing anything to anybody. You know, my job was to figure out how to bend whatever was going on in the world that was not as I wanted it to my will, and to do that completely by myself. And that's not who I am today. You know, my first instinct when something is bigger than me is to ask for help. And that wasn't a natural process. You know, that was the first step for me, is that, you know, there are a lot of things in the world that are my responsibility. You know, the first step was not something that was easy for me. You know, when we first read that in a meeting when I showed up at NA, I thought, you know, this is all about weaseling out, you know, like about avoiding personal responsibility. Like, you know, there's some things in the world that you're responsible for, and saying that you're powerless over stuff doesn't make it not true. That's a load of crap. You know, like, I'm responsible for what I do. You know, these people are trying to make everybody not responsible for this stuff they do. Like, I'm not down with that. And, but I was direct enough to tell my sponsor what I really thought about that. And my sponsor had been clean a long time, and she was very direct enough to just give me writing assignment after writing assignment after writing assignment until I understood what powerlessness was. And I understood what unmanageability was, because I hardly had time to shower, like, between the writing assignments, because there were firm due dates on those things, you know? And, you know, I finally got it that I couldn't be personally responsible for stuff while I was refusing to be powerless, to act powerless over the things that I was powerless over, you know? Like, if I refuse to acknowledge gravity and its effect on me, I increase the powerlessness and unmanageability in my life. You know, that it's not avoiding personal responsibility to acknowledge the laws of nature and their effect on me. That's being responsible. And that they're related, but not in the way I imagined. You know, and it was a really humbling thing for me to realize how little I knew about the shit that I thought I knew all. See, there I go. Not the classic Sunday morning speaker. But
You got it back.
Yep, I will. It's the only thing that's ever worked for me. But it was really humbling to realize how little I knew about the stuff that I just knew. You know, all the stuff that I knew. And so I really needed a second step. You know, I needed something that was in my corner, you know, and that was going to have me, you know, that I could go to. And so the second step, after a thorough first step, realizing the unmanageability of my life is really tough too, because when I got to Narcotics Anonymous, you know, thank God for the people that were here when I got here, because, you know, there were a number of them that really made me feel welcome and made me a part of, and one of the things they did was pack me up and bring me to this camp out long years ago. And, you know, even though, because of who I was, I showed up here with, like, stuff I had made for the camp out. Like, I thought when you went camping, you were supposed to bring, like, cold asparagus with a vinaigrette sauce and fancy shrimp skewers and stuff like that. I mean, I had, you know, it was camping for Martha Stewart, you know. And so I had three coolers full of all this stuff. And so people kind of looked at me a little strangely, like, and they had hot dogs and hamburgers and marshmallows and all this stuff. And I thought, wow, like, these people are children. Like, this is what children eat when they cook out in the backyard. You know, like, wow. I'm like, okay. But everybody ate my food, though. They liked it. You know, and I thought, wow, maybe I'll help them. You know, I will help these people learn how to eat correctly. And I had big bowls of salad. And, like, the salad lasted, like, literally 45 seconds. Like, people fell on this. They were like, wow, what is that stuff? And I was like, it's a country cob salad with pine nuts. And they were like, what are pine nuts? And then I turned around, and the salad was gone. And I thought, I didn't get any salad. I made that salad. It was big enough to serve like 25 people, and I didn't get any salad. You know, and my sponsor just looked at me and smiled, and she said, "It's all about being of service to other people, Denise. Good for you." You know, and I was like, I wanted some salad. Like, I made the salad because I like it. You know? Okay, you know, like, I'll keep coming back. But anyway, so I didn't think, I knew that I was powerless over my disease, but unmanageability wasn't clear to me because, like, I had a job and a house and a car and I owned a business and you know, I wasn't, like, arrested or, like, you know, I came to NA because I thought it would be a really good idea to, like, stop scaring my dog. Like, the only thing that was really upset about my using was my dog, because everybody else, I ran their life. Like, I was the queen of the universe, and I kept everybody I kept all the balls in the air and everybody at such a good distance that nobody else could object to what I was doing to myself. So it took me about 4 or 5 years to realize just how dangerous that was, how close to the edge of dying I skated, because there was no one to say to me, except my dog, who was like, ooh, yeah. And it took me a long time to realize just exactly what was happening in my life, but I didn't have any cool using stories. Like, I would come to meetings and listen to people tell cool using stories, and I would feel left out. I'd be like, I don't have any cool using stories. I didn't use with people. I didn't have any cool using stories. And my sponsor would be like, that's okay. You know, like, you definitely qualify, because the reason why you don't have any cool using stories is you weren't willing to share. Yeah. Okay, so that definitely means that you belong here. Keep coming back. And I was like, okay. So everything I came up with, she had an answer for, you know? She was great. And so by the time I got finished with this, you know, harrowing first step, the second step was a gimme. You know, it was like, and, you know, she, of course, didn't let me skim over it because that's deadly. But it was, that was very easy for me after the first step, which felt like being beaten with sticks. But so turning my, you know, making a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of the higher power that I found here was actually quite easy because I was exhausted at that point. And so I did, of course, miss on the first pass through that the really important thing was about making a decision. So I had that pointed out to me very, very pointedly, you know, like that it isn't that you turn your will and your life over, it's that you make a decision that you're responsible for. You and your personal responsibility crap. You're making a decision. And I was like, I make decisions all the time. I don't have any trouble making decisions. I can make decisions all the time. I make decisions for all kinds of people, 1,000 people. You know, well, that's not the point. This is a decision for you. It's about your life and responsibility for your life and your recovery. So, you know, get quiet and make the decision. It's a decision that you make every day. And that decision, and one of the things I'm really grateful for is I got taught that that's a decision that has its anchoring in every decision that I make every day. That every decision that I make, little, big, medium, everything, either moves me closer to my recovery or closer to my disease. That, you know, I decide, oh, I've had a really long day. I don't really feel like going to a meeting. You know, I went to a meeting yesterday. You know, blah, 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 blah. That's the voice of my disease yammering at me. Because I don't know what's going to happen at that meeting. I don't know who's at that meeting that needs me, or I don't know who's at that meeting that has something that I need. I don't know if a meteor is going to fall on my house while I'm at that meeting, and going to that meeting will save my life, even if nothing decent happens while I'm at that meeting. If nothing but, you know, absolute insanity goes on at that meeting, I'll come home and find a crater where my house was, and it will have saved my life to have gone to that meeting in some different way. There are things that I just cannot know. But my job is to look at every decision in the context of, does this move me closer to recovery or does this move me farther away from it? And so I was taught to do that before I had 30 days clean. That, you know, everything that I do is a third step related decision. And so I still think like that. Long before I was able to work, like write a formal four step, the other really good training that I got in preparation for a four step, every time I would say something, like something when, you know, when I was newly clean, everything frightened me. I was terrified of everything. I was, because I had people yammering at me about, like, I couldn't stay clean in NA, not NA people, not anybody else, but other people, external people, yammering at me about, like, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this other thing, you can't stay clean in NA. And NA were the only people that wanted me when I got clean. And I wanted them, you know, and actually I was staying clean in NA, and I loved NA. And so, but anytime anybody twitched left or right or did something strange or actually, you know, when I was getting clean, people shot at each other after meetings to settle disputes. So that startled me a little bit because I had never seen it. Where I grew up, people didn't do that. You know, like, so I was sort of like, ooh, okay, this is not good. You know, somebody immediately moved to policing up the brass, and the cops showed up. They lied to the cops. They were like, oh, it sounded like it came from over there. And we looked pretty tight, you know, hooked up. We're standing outside a church telling them it sounded like it came from over there. They raced off looking for the, you know, the bad people over there. You know, and I thought, oh, my God, where am I? Like, who are these people? You know, like, and I thought, well, these people are me. You know, like, I just stood here and did nothing, too. You know, watched somebody police up the brass, watched the cops race off, and just said nothing. You know, like, so shit would scare me, you know. And so I would race to my sponsor and go, And my sponsor would say, look around very pointedly, and she'd say, I don't see Susie Q here. Why are we talking about Susie Q? And I'd say, well, I'm upset. And she'd say, well, you'll be able to survive your feelings. Don't worry about that. But Susie Q ain't here. So we don't talk about Susie Q. There's only two things that happen about Susie Q. If we're concerned about Susie Q, we go talk to her. If you don't feel like you can do it by yourself, I'll go with you. But we don't talk about Susie Q. And I was like, but I'm upset. And she said, well, then talk to me about how you feel. But don't talk to me about Susie Q. Doesn't matter what Susie Q did. It matters how you feel. You're responsible for your feelings. You're not, you know, what Susie Q did is Susie Q's shit. Let her talk to her sponsor. And I was like, oh, well, how am I supposed to tell you how I feel if I don't tell you what Susie Q did? And she's like, well, you're going to need to figure that out. So tell me how you feel. So I learned words like overwhelmed and angry and frustrated. You know, like I learned how to talk about how I felt without talking about Susie Q. And I learned how to go talk to somebody and express my concern for them. Over time, without being offensive. You know, and also letting go of how that was received. Because even when I'm not offensive, when I do that sometimes, people are offended. Like, I don't have any control over how people receive what I do. I only have control over how I behave. So, you know, I do hear a lot about how frightening I am. But here's the thing. You know, I take care of, like, sick, vulnerable people. I take care of little, tiny, baby people who are not frightened of me. I take care of sick, frightened, vulnerable animals. And those things and people find me trustworthy and undaunting. It is not my responsibility how I'm received. It's my responsibility how I approach. And I got that. Like, I'm responsible for that.
It's your honesty.
And, yeah, but don't ask me what I really think. Don't do that unless you want to know. Because I will tell you. Like, I learned about 10 years ago how to tell the truth without using it like a weapon. But I will tell you the truth, so don't ask if you don't want to know. I don't volunteer that like I used to, but don't ask me if you don't want to know. You know, my grand sponsor one time told me, like, she watched me volunteer the truth to somebody and watched it bounce off the front of their forehead, and she said to me, baby, what you did is just cast pearls before swine. Why do you do that? It's a waste of your time and energy. She said, if they ask you, it's fine to tell them, but why do you do that? Like, we could have gone to the mall. She loved to go to Denny's. She said, you could have taken me to Denny's for breakfast. We could have used that time to do so many other things. And I'm old, she said. I'm going to die soon, and I want to go to Denny's. And I was like, I said, I'm sorry, Sydney. I'll take you to Denny's right now. Well, I did. I put her right in the car and took her to Denny's. And I said, okay. And that's all it took for me to learn. Like, I was like, okay, she's right. There's no point in doing this. There's absolutely no point. And I haven't done it since. So I don't volunteer that shit anymore. But if you ask me, I'll tell you. But in that whole process of, like, learning not to talk about Susie Q, what my sponsor taught me as well is that I wouldn't be upset about what Susie Q was doing if it didn't have something to do with me. So she turned all that right around on me, just like a mirror, just like a stick. And she said, well, why is what Susie Q doing bothering you? What is it that's similar to what you have done or are doing? Why are you angry about this? Why are you upset? Why are you judging Susie Q? Or why is, you know, what is it? What if, you know, how is this similar to you? And write this all down, because this is going to be useful on your fourth step. It's going to show up again. There in 7-8. So write it all down. Make a careful note of this. Put it in a separate place, not in your journal. Because you're going to need this information. It's going to be useful to you. Because other people are the best way that we see ourselves. So write it all down. So I learned not to gossip. See, I learned not to act on my defects out of self-defense. You know, I was like, oh God, if every time I come gripe about somebody to my sponsor, she's going to turn this into some like potential disastrous delving into my defects. Maybe I don't want to do this. Maybe I wish not to act on this particular defect just because I don't need this. You know, maybe I'm not upset about what Susie Q did. Maybe that's fine if she does that. So I learned to be more accepting and less judgmental of other people. In part because I learned to recognize what they're doing is related to me. It's like, well, wait a minute. That looks a little like, it's not exactly like, but it looks a little like something I did that I don't like about myself. Let me focus on that. Because, like, Susie Q has her own story, her own process, like her own sponsor, her own. Oh, no worries. I thought it was me. I was sure I turned that off. I know I turned my phone off. How did that happen? Thank goodness it was you. Okay. Talk about coming to believe. Like my phone. Yesterday some of the most random stuff happens to me, good and bad. But today the most amazing thing happened. Like I have my friend Angie's grandbabies with me, and one of them was like having difficulty breathing. I'm giving her nebulizer treatment. As soon as she can breathe and catch her breath, she says, "That fire over there finally has beautiful coals. Like, it's been burning since yesterday." She says, "I have to have some marshmallows." She just finished eating breakfast. It's like 9 o'clock in the morning. And I said, "Well, honey, your grandma took your marshmallows home." Little tears welled up in her eyes. And I was like, "Oh, honey, like, I don't know what I can do. Let me see what I can do to find some marshmallows." And I look around and I realize there's nobody that I really know in the immediate area. And I thought, well, all right, you know, we're all friends here, so let me go see what I can do. So I set off, and I get to one place, and they say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, we don't have any marshmallows, but, you know, those people over there were making s'mores last night. They might have some marshmallows." So I wander over there, and sure enough, it's this lovely couple and their little kids, and they said, "Oh, yeah, we have all kinds of marshmallows. We have chocolate and everything else, and you're welcome to it. Take whatever you want. Here, we have sticks, too, and everything," and they start giving me some. And so I tell them my sad story about Zeta, and they said, "Oh, well, does she need clothes? Like, how big is she?" You know, like, and I said, "Oh, yeah, she's freezing. Like, she's over there. Like, she has a tank top and a pair of shorts on. She's freezing." They stripped the clothes right off their child. They said, their little girl Madison, who's beautiful, they said, "She's about to outgrow these pants, and they're clean. She just slept in them last night. But these are almost too small for her. We're getting ready to pass them on to somebody else. And we have a jacket, too." And they disappeared in the back, and they came out with this beautiful, like, pink princess jacket and these leopard print pants and gave them to me. And so here I'm leaving with a fork, two bags of marshmallows, and clothes for the child. And I'm thinking, you have got to love my correspondence. You know, they talk about, like, you don't get to decide where you get things from, but you always get what you need, and you get more than you need a lot of times, like an abundance, an embarrassment of gifts. You know, like, I looked there, I could barely hold what I had. You know, I'm like, and the child's face lit up. She was like, "That's for me?" And I was like, "Oh, yes, honey. A cute little girl named Madison sent this to you." She was like, "Madison? That's a pretty name." And I was like, "Yes, it is. And she has such a pretty spirit. She sent all this to you." And she was so happy. And she's been just as sweet to her sister. They've been behaving so nicely this morning. Aren't you good girls? Mm-hmm. And so the thing that I love about Narcotics Anonymous is that it's about the freedom to do anything. It's about freedom from active addiction, but it's also about freedom to do anything. And, you know, I learned about that, strangely enough, in a fist step. You know, like, I had not imagined, and working a fist step with my sponsor's kind of, my sponsor that I worked a fist step with is kind of rough trade. I mean, if you haven't gathered that from what I've said, let me just say that specifically. She was well known for being, anybody that thinks like that I'm frightening or bossy should meet her. When I first got clean, she rearranged things in my house. Like, she decided what I needed was a new environment. So that, because I did most of my using in my house. So she brought a bunch of addicts over to my house after a meeting one day when I had less than 30 days clean. They took all the furniture out of my house, set it on the lawn, and then she directed them where to put stuff back. And she moved me into a completely different bedroom than the one I had been living in. So I pretty much left everything as she had it, except for this one stone Egyptian cat that I liked. And she put it in my living room. I didn't think it belonged there, so I moved it into my bedroom where I liked it. Every time she came over, she would move that. And then I would move it again. And then she would move it back. It was like a game. We'd move this cat back and forth and back and forth. I still have that cat. And now it stays where I want it, because she lives out of the area. But only because she does not visit my house regularly. What she also did at the same time is she went through all my stuff, unbeknownst to me. Like, I was toxic. So she went through all my stuff. She decided I had way too many towels and way too many clothes. So she bagged them up and gave them away to a bunch of people. So one day I was in a meeting. I said to this girl, "Wow, you look great. That's a beautiful dress. You look so nice today." And she was like you kind of rolled her eyes at me. She said, "I guess you would say that. Like, it's your dress." Yeah, and what kind of person has a dress like this and it still has tags on it anyway? You're like, whatever. And I was like, okay. How did you get my dress? And she said, "Myra gave it to me." And I was like, "Oh, that's great. All right. Really?" And Myra's like, "Oh, yeah, I took like 5 bags, big trash bags full of stuff out of your house and gave it away. And you haven't even noticed until you saw Gail wearing your dress." And I was like, "Okay, whatever, you're right. That's fine." So that's what old-style sponsorship was like. It's just decide how your life is supposed to be between the cat and all my stuff. But so I was really a little daunted about going over my fist step with her, like about like what might happen, you know, given what had already happened, like in and out of step work, you know, just in my life and in step work. And, you know, and it talks about in our literature that our sponsors share stories with us. And for the first time, really, she did. Other than, I mean, she had shared some little snippets of stuff with me before, but really in my fist step, she shared a lot more information about herself with me. And it really gave me this sense of hope and freedom to do anything. Like, what the change in her life had been, both from who she had been born to be, what she had done to trash her life, and then how she had reconfigured her life in recovery, that sort of change in process, and how overall satisfied she really was with her life, really filled me with this sense of peace. And the level at which she was just accepting and matter-of-fact about my fifth step and the assignments that she gave me relative to the sixth step really just uh, was a real turning point. Our literature talks about that. It really was a turning point for me. It was not the unpleasant experience that I hear people talking about all the time. And it always makes me wonder, like, when people talk about that, how terrible it was, if it's because they really didn't do it. They're talking about it and not doing it, I don't know. But having done that work, it was easy and obvious for me. It started being really obvious in my day-to-day life, my defects. You know, just that, from that sense of hope and calm that came from my fifth step, you know, I would more and more have the experience of, like, saying something without thinking about it, and then really being able to see the hurt in somebody's face that I didn't intend, that I really did not mean, and then feel terrible about it, but not be able to take it back, and just not know what to do about it. You know, like, well, how could I have done that any differently? And get a different understanding of powerlessness from that. And over time, the result of that really was a very real willingness to ask for relief from that, from my higher power, to say, you know what, I've tried everything I know how to exert control over this. This is the same as my addiction. I'm willing to do my part. I'm willing to do whatever I can. But there's parts of this that are beyond my control. So I need some fundamental change. And I need to be shown what that is, what kind of fundamental change. There's some where 4 or 5 steps back in this process that something needs to be different, and I don't get what it is. And so I'm willing. And so in the process of writing that, you know, I didn't really, you know, one of the things I chanted over and over again during this whole process was, like, I hadn't really done anybody any harm. That whole thing about, like, I kept everybody at a great far distance. You know, I got that I was doing immediate day-to-day harm because I could see that hurt in people's face. You know, I could see where I was doing that kind of harm. But I kept talking about, like, in my active addiction, like, I didn't, you know, drive around and crash into people. I didn't get arrested. I didn't steal anything from anybody. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. You know, I didn't rip anybody off. Or I didn't do this. I didn't do that. And finally one day, Myra said, well, you know, what about the people, like, you spent all your time that you weren't at work using, and don't you think that when you were loaded, the next day, you know, you were probably pretty cranky, you know, like, or whatever, like, maybe you were mean to your employees, you know, like, and what about the people that might have wanted to see you when you were busy using, you know? And I think I'm out of time, right? Okay. Yeah, see how long I'm talking about the steps. Like, I would stay here all day. Like, sorry. I'm going up to the 8th step. But anyway, so this is a good place to wrap up anyway. But, or else it'll be a mystery. But, but my, grandmother, so what finally, I finally hit on something, because Myra's like, well, you're not moving on to any other step, so you come up with something on this step. Forget it. Like, nobody gets out of writing this step. You better come up with something. So I was like, so it finally dawned on me that the one thing I did do was that, and she kept thinking, well, surely in the dim recesses of your stupid mind, you remember seeing that hurt look on somebody's face when you were loaded at some point. And I was like, I never saw anybody. I never saw anybody. I kept saying, I never saw anybody. I never saw anybody. She said, well, sometime when you were recovering from being loaded, you must have seen somebody. Think, you know, like, So finally it occurred to me that the one thing I did do was that my poor grandmother, I was her first grandchild, and she loved me more than anything in the world. And I used to eat Sunday dinner at her house every Sunday in Waynesboro. And you could show up with one person, three people, five people. She didn't care. She had enough food for an army. And she didn't need any kind of notice. She didn't care. My grandmother loved everybody and everything. She didn't care who you showed up with. I could have stopped and picked up some homeless dude from behind a dumpster and brought him. She would have let him take a shower and fed him. That's the kind of Christian woman she was. So I would tell her I was coming for Sunday dinner. Then I would, like, get loaded and miss it. Yeah, exactly. So usually, 90% of the time, I would call and tell her I wasn't going to make it. At work or something would interfere. But every now and then, I'd be too trashed to remember to call. And I wouldn't call until later. I always called, but I often sometimes didn't call until after it was time to eat. So after I got clean, I realized that when I showed up for Sunday dinner, there would not be a place on the table for me. There would be on the buffet a plate, a napkin, and a set of silverware. And when I walked in, she would move the plates and set my place. And this went on for months, maybe a year, I don't remember how long, but I was incensed. I mean, for years, years and years and years and years and years, I showed up like clockwork. I fixed her bathroom, I fixed her roof, I carried her and my grandpa back and forth to the doctor. I mean, I was like little Miss Reliable about everything except for this one 12-month period. And during that period, I showed up about more than 50% of the time, on time. 90% of the time when I didn't show up, I called. So this is like a 10% time. So my sponsor said to me, think about what that means about how upset she was, how much this hurt her, how frightened she was for you, because you're coming over Afton Mountain to see her. Think about what this means about what effect it has on her, that she cannot think that you're going to be there until she sees you. And fuck you, she said. You know, you will make amends to your grandmother until your grandmother is over this. Because I was all upset and excited about how dare her not have a place set for me. I had been clean now all this time, and I had never missed. My whole life I've done nothing but show up for my grandmother. I had this one little period where I don't show up. I was doing this, and my mother was like, shut up. Shut up. And I was like, okay, all right. She said, this is what you're going to write about. You know, this is your eighth step. Like, write it. Okay. All right. So I did. Thank you for letting me share. Great. 3 years. 3 years.